This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Pragita Sharma and Kate Morris. Hi, everyone. This is the final episode in a series of episodes about the 19th Amendment Project, a collection of plays commissioned by Burning Coal Theater and co-produced by the League of Women Voters of Wake County and 12 other Triangle Area Theater companies. The one takeaway from all of these conversations is the fact that the history of the suffragette movement is a complicated one. In fact, poet Pragita Sharma and playwright Kate R. Morris, co-collaborators on the play On the Roof in the Tombs, tell me that the only way they could reconcile this history and find an authentic voice was to weave together classic poetic form with conventional playwriting mechanics. Here is Morris to begin our conversation.
I had a hard time being able to talk about the right to vote from a present perspective, celebrating what the right to vote meant at this period of time and how the vote has actually been fought for several times over the history between the passing of the 19th Amendment and where we are now, where voting is still a really hard issue to talk about. And when you have to write these historical figures, it can be really difficult to write for them. And so we kind of took on, Pragita introduced me to this poetic form called the cento, which is a way of writing with a figure from the past by repeating what they have already written or spoken for the historical record and then writing in conversation with that. And so that's a lot of what this play does, by putting these characters into a scenario with each other and writing both things that they have said already and things that they would potentially say to each other in these scenarios. And it's a good way to also critique the hegemony of history in our country and what doesn't get talked about enough.
When you pull all these historical figures together, how much artistic license can you take, or how much do you have to stick to the facts?
I think that sticking to the facts is really important, especially when it comes to the silencing that white suffragists in this country did to Black suffragists and other suffragists of color, and where they took a lot of their practices from that was not at the time properly credited to Native American practices of negotiation and egalitarian forms of like self-governance and self-determination. There's a lot of that going on that I still don't know enough about. And so the license comes in for me in, I found myself being able to take a lot more license with certain white characters that I really felt like I identified with, like Inez Mulholland and Margaret Hinchey, who both have personal histories that intersect with mine in a way that I felt okay speaking for them. I don't know. Pragita, what do you think about that?
I thought it was hard to enter in. I had initially approached Kate about thinking about, I thought about Montana and Jeanette Rankin, but the more I sort of researched Rankin, the more I felt conflicted about her role, just as we did with Alice Paul and with Susan B. Anthony and E.C. Stanton, with Stanton. And so I wanted to think about how could I enter in to an engagement with the racial tensions of the time, without obviously identifying culturally and with the characters. So I sort of approached Kate with a kind of conversation around the Central Park Literary Walk Monument, the Women's Rights Pioneer Monument that was going to kind of be completed in the coming year. And the statues would be Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Stanton. I entered in with that kind of conundrum, brought our research and our responses and our reactions together to see if we could build a conversation among them.
Well, and what's so interesting about this whole process is we are theater makers. So by our very nature, that's collaborative. And yet here we are in a period of COVID when collaboration is a little bit different. So what does collaboration look like in a time of COVID, particularly when you guys are in separate parts of the country?
For me, a lot of our collaboration came, well, I was in Mexico at the time that we started this project. And I feel like more than the doing the work itself, just taking the time to really meet each other where we were at in our lives in order to sort through that and then begin the work. I feel like collaboration in the time of COVID needs to make space for the state and temperature of the, and I'm using temperature in a really weird way. I'm using it like as like a broader idea of like, I guess, homeostasis of where the artists are when they meet each other. Like, Brigida, I remember us having conversations that were a lot about how we were meeting the world. And through those conversations, we could talk about how much we were not writing as much as we wanted to. And then we could eventually get to the task of doing the writing of the work. And that's why it maybe took 3 months. It takes so much longer now. And COVID is able to allow for that type of activism in a way that reaches across physical regions. That's the good part, I think, of what collaboration in times of COVID is affording us, right? Or rewarding us with, is that we are actually quiet enough to notice or participate in a new way. I think also understanding, right now I'm looking at how we are trying to get things done with keeping people safe, but also preserving, not even preserving, but fighting for equal rights right now, right? And so much of what we're being told is that things need to be done in an appropriate way. And that was the silencing that was done with Black suffragists at the time of the passing of the amendment. And that's why we have these two white women who effectively silenced so many other people because they were worried about how appropriate their presence was in a movement that was working toward equality and voices for all of it. I mean, voting is a voice, right? And we're thinking about the silencing of voices, and we're seeing right now, post in our COVID times, a bunch of silencing going on. It was hard to ignore that, and I think it made its way into our play in a kind of through a side door or a back door, at least for my thinking. I can't speak for Brigida, but
I mean, I think I think everything we were just trying to examine as many ways into this play as we could.
Yeah.
And to think about, I mean, we kept facing the inequity that was an outrageous inequity that I think fueled our revisions.
Oh, definitely. And compounded by what, for me anyway, compounded by what I would see every day and what I would spend my time outside my home doing. Because once I moved back to Montana, I could leave my home with a very low sense of risk. And what was worth putting a mask on and getting out into the streets about Is this still this issue? Still this issue of not acknowledging the humanity and voice of marginalized people, people who have been marginalized by the hegemony of whiteness. It was hard not to write a play about voting without really interrogating that.
Pargita, your parents immigrated to this country from India. So I'm curious, how does your cultural heritage, your background, inform how you view that intersectionality of race and gender and this complicated history of the suffrage movement?
You know, there was just a little piece of dialogue in the play that Kate and I talked about and that I kind of wrote in that I wanted to explore a little more deeply, which is the relationship that Gandhi had with the movement in the UK. And I wanted to make some connections between the suffrage movement in India that rose out of the Swadeshi movement in Bengal, and then relate somehow the kind of the wearing of white and the ideas of empowerment that came from India and possibly what was happening in the UK and then what trickled to the US. But that beyond this kind of one little sort of section of dialogue is all I really could do in thinking about the history of that kind of activism. It's something I want to look more deeply into. And there are some really interesting intersectional work on kind of activism in India and analysis of BIPOC activism in the States in the, you know, early 20th century. But that didn't make its way in. There's a book called Colored Cosmopolitans, and there was some really interesting work there. So Kate and I ended up doing a lot of research to imagine certain connections that it was hard to write them in. Although Kate did such an extraordinary job with this play, she really imagined and wrote a lot of this. And I felt as a poet, I couldn't do enough of the experimental lyric that I am so keen on because I didn't want to imagine language for many of these characters.
I also could not have done a lot of the work that became the play without Pragita guiding our focus and our path of research. She would bring me questions that then, and talk about how we could answer it. And if we couldn't answer it through poetic lyricism, because it would have been a form of appropriation that neither of us wanted to do. I'm lucky enough to understand how the machine of a play works in order to try and do it in a different way that's not stealing a voice, but maybe reframing it or repackaging it in a different visual capacity. So there's a lot of the imagery of the play is, I think, how we were trying to really amplify some of these ideas. The characters spend a lot of time fighting time. A lot of the duration of the play is a couple of characters in a boxing match. And then there is a lot of placement of bodies into a statue form and replacing of bodies into a statue form. And that type of dramatic action is something that playwrights can work with, where, I mean, I'm not the poet that Pragita is, so I couldn't do a lot of the things that she would be able to do if this was a cento on a page. But the Cento form really, I think, gave us the kind of permission we needed, or at least I needed.
Well, and it sounds like you have a lot of statue imagery in this play. Did this idea of the statues and the problem of how we remember history and memorialize history through these monuments, did that play a part in the play?
Oh, I think it was absolutely informed by what was happening in the news. That's what I think part of our kind of concern about the play is, how do we respond to our current events and think about, you know, the 19th Amendment, as well as think about the 15th Amendment and the tension that the white suffragists had in fighting someone like Ida Wells and Wells Barnett, and not thinking about who they represented, who these figures, these statues represented to outside of white culture.
Yeah, I mean, totally. There's too much of it. There's so much that people who grow up in this country, who come from white backgrounds like mine, they don't understand what the history of our nation actually is. And I feel like the work of a cultural worker, like a playwright, is to tell those stories, is to be a storyteller that asks someone to say, actually look again and look around you. So if this play isn't doing that job, I mean, I think that's the job of theater.
Well, let's go there, because I think that's one of the things I love about theater, is that it can speak to our history and help us navigate the present. So how do you feel, and nobody does the history play genre, nobody produces the history play better than Burning Coal. That is truly their forte in this geographical area. So when we look at the history play, or we look at theater, how does theater and the arts influence our collective conscious and even inform how we remember the past and how we interpret our present or what's going on around us?
I think that there are many ways to do it. I am not an expert in history play for sure, because this is the first historical play I've ever taken on. I'm a magical realism person. A lot of my plays are poetic and lyrical, and they really blur the line in reality. But I think this is where, I really think this is where the Cento is. I don't know how a history play works, but I know that our history play that we wrote only works because it is a Cento, because when Brigida initially wrote a play using some of these, I mean, a poem using some of these voices, that was like a portal into them. And it's a way of bringing the past into a present framing. And poetry, I think, does that really well. I think what history plays do are embody it for people, so they make it more real. And so that there is that like chemical transmission of watching someone, like the mirror neurons in the brain have that relationship solidified. And so they are able to kind of reach across the years or the centuries. But I feel like poetry has done that first and does that in a way that really frees the imagination. I think it's a slippery slope, though, to re-perform history, especially in an art form like theater that still has a lot of work to do as far as which voices it amplifies.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about the poetic form. So what I had done originally was give Kate a villanelle with contemporary poets and our early figures in the movement. That was in the villanelle form, which a villanelle is a sort of a structure where you have repeated lines, and it's very formal. To move from the villanelle to the cento and to have those be these kind of speech acts of the characters, and to have that be from history, felt like the only way in, a way to make their voices timeless as we are negotiating the theme of time.
And the idea of speech acts is so important to me. I'm so glad that you brought that up, Brigida, because that is, I think, the overlap of the Venn diagram between history plays and poetic forms such as villanelles and centos, is this idea of a speech act is essential for both, for all of those things to exist in the mind of either a reader or an audience member, right? And what a history play does is build a narrative around historical speech acts and give them bodies in which to really experience. There's something to be said for the shared experience of an audience with another person embodying the speech acts of a historical figure or a piece of our history. It's that kind of binding mechanism.
And what is the significance of giving these historical figures voice against the backdrop of current Black Lives Matter protests, the current wave of the women's rights movement, the pandemic that we're living in? What's the significance of giving them voice now?
I think that there has been a glossing over in history. One of the things that I have been undertaking in my anti-racism work is to go back and read history by Black historians who are talking about our nation in a way that I was not taught in school. And the way that I was taught in school was a lie. And it is deeply hurtful to me that I did not understand this nation that I live in until I was in my 30s after moving out of a predominantly white area like the white rural United States. And it's a different lived experience than probably either of you have had. But for me, it is something that I take very seriously, and was, because I had to be a person who wrote this play, this was one of the ways that I undertook this project, was from this viewpoint of, well, we have to go back and relook at the history, because to write about something from this point, I think it's too early for me to be able to write it from a full lived experience. I'm still learning. This is one of the hardest, this is the hardest short play I've ever had to write. It was extremely difficult to even feel like I could take on this subject. And I really hid inside the mechanics of playwriting for it. Being like, oh, if these people are in this space and they're saying, and this is what they have said in the past, okay, we'll put them in a position where I won't have to assert my own ideas too much as a writer. I didn't want my hand to be seen very much at all in it, which is a weird role for a playwright to take on, because usually the playwright's hand is something that is celebrated in theater and theater making. But I'm not sure where it would be appropriate for me specifically to show my hand here.
Well, and I wonder too, Kate, in this world of COVID that we're living in, there has been such an increase in gender-based violence, particularly in countries like Mexico. And I know you spent a lot of time in Guadalajara, and you mentioned at the beginning of this that when you started this project, you were there. So how does having spent so much time in Mexico influence how you view the intersectionality between race and gender?
It's such a complicated issue. Before we went into COVID lockdown, the week before, I and I think every other woman in my life in Mexico all went to the streets to protest against femicide for a Paro Nacional. And we did an activity. I was teaching at a school, and it was shocking and alarming for me to read accounts from my female students about how my male students had treated them in situations outside of the classroom, specifically in club situations, and the shocking amount of sexual assault that would happen to my female students, even being in an extremely affluent social class. I was teaching at a school where the lifestyle was very much not what I think a lot of people's stereotypes of Mexico. This was something that would maybe defy some of those stereotypes. It was something that I was not prepared for it myself growing up in a poor rural area. It is an extremely intersectional issue that is hard to describe within a podcast about a play about the vote. But I think what really has struck me is the amount of social propriety that goes into silencing the voices of women. And that is something that is very much reinforced by a patriarchal structure. And it's very much present in the post-colonial attitudes of affluent Mexican culture, specifically in the one in Guadalajara. These girls could speak out in certain spaces, but they couldn't speak out in certain spaces about certain things because they were women and because the violence perpetrated against them was not something that their class would protect. Now, in other parts of the city that I was not a part of, I think the pressure was a lot more. I think the women who, there was a day we did a general strike and every woman stayed home. And the many men and boys threw a fit about it. And you could tell the women who still went to work. They were women who didn't have a choice not to go to work. And that's a social issue. That has everything to do with income. And I mean, who knows what would happen if they had a voice that was loud enough to be heard by the people who make decisions. I think that's something that Mexico is still figuring out. The silencing of women happens a lot more prevalently, and it always happens before a woman is hurt or murdered.
And Brigida, I'm curious, because in your work, you've written a lot about community, who gets to be part of that community, whose voices count in that community. And a lot of that has to do with race and gender. So talk to me a little bit about that exploration in your own work, about this idea of community and activism and who gets to be part of the club.
Yes, it's complicated. I mean, we look at all of the kind of communities that make up our identity, you know, certainly from adolescence into our 20s and then our careers. And I think I ended up writing a lot about, as a poet, about, you know, academia. And while that is both agreed to be a non-reality, it's very much a reality. The ivory tower is full of this challenging inequity. So it's complicated for me to be, you know, thinking about how you write homes, which feel so bohemian, and then an examination, obviously, of critical race theory. And so I think sort of like a long way around, but through academia and through reading critical race theory, I was able to examine how I could have a voice and think about important topics like resilience that come out of writing poetry, or the witness of how we have a voice by documenting our experiences, our resilience, our trauma, and having its vibrance matter. I don't know if that really answered your question, but I've just been thinking about the role of the poet in the institution, and we get to mediate a very unique space. It's not academic in the sense that we don't have to write the critical analysis, but we get to have an embodied space of analysis. So I guess for me, thinking about poetry is a way of thinking about lineage, kinship, and activating of voices. That's what poetry means to me, I guess. And when you ask me questions like that, I go back to thinking about the essential kind of feelings I have about poetry.
Do you, and I'll ask this of both of you, Kate, let me start with you. Do you think that this moment historically is going to mark a cultural shift in the types of stories we're seeing on stage and who gets to tell those stories?
I am naive enough to hope that that's true. But I have a voice inside of me that says otherwise. I think every day I wake up with two people in my head, the cynic and the naive, hopeful person, and that they just basically have a conversation every day over what's going to happen and when. I know for the little work that I can do in my little corner of the world, that is what I'm working toward. By amplifying other voices and seeking out the stories that I think should be told.
I mean, for me, I've been, I just last semester actually in the fall, I taught an Asian American lit class from 1960 to the present. And we started to examine the relationship between Asian American theater and poetry. And so many of the figures were involved with both at that time because it was such a small community and yet such an active community. And so I think, I guess, in the institution, we're just uncovering and engaging with our histories and trying to make them into classes so that our students celebrate more. I hope that I think there are lots of plays that need to be, have some discovery into their, their initial premieres. We need to be looking back at our retrospective.
What can we learn about these historical figures that you've written about in this play? What can we learn from them about resilience?
I really kind of got to take a deep dive into Frances Watkins Harper's early work.
There is a line that Harper says, wake from your guilty sleep.
The idea of waking from guilty sleep is really important. There's a Wells quote that we used as well that I think is really relevant to this. Virtue knows no color line, and the chivalry which depends on complexion of skin and texture of hair can command no honest respect. But the beginning of that is virtue knows no color line. Wells talking about virtue and chivalry, I think, comes from a place of resilience and an embodiment of resilience.
Should I give away the end of our play with the quote that we end on?
Heck yeah.
Racism aside, many white women suffragists sought the vote only for themselves Conversely, African American women were universal suffragists in the sense that their voices called for the vote for all citizens, not just for themselves. And we thought that really taught us about resilience or the message of the play.
And I take it as, I remember that idea every day that we move forward into what hopefully is a more just society in this country, is to not seek something only for ourselves, to dig deep and have the resilience to seek it for all people.
Morris and Sharma's play On the Roof in the Tombs is available to stream virtually just until the end of this month. I'll put a link to Burning Coal's website in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, become a patron of this program, follow us on social media at RDU On Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.